today's episode of Hear Us Out, we're thrilled to welcome a master behind the mix, Mark Carolan. He is a world-renowned sound engineer, best known for his long-standing work with Muse, where his innovative approach to live sound has helped shape some of the most electrifying concert experiences of the last two decades. With a career that spans the globe and includes collaborations with artists like The Cure and Snow Patrol, Mark brings deep expertise, technical brilliance, and a rare perspective on what it really takes to bring music to life on stage and in the studio. Mark Carolan, welcome to Hear Us Out.
Hi, nice to meet you guys.
Nice to meet you as well. So can you start off by telling us a little bit about your background and how you got into professional sound?
Yeah, you know, like a lot of people who end up where I end up, it's kind of a convoluted, you know, non-linear path. I always played music from when I was very young. I studied classical violin, and then I kind of, as soon as I became a teenager, that kind of went in the bin, and I became a punk rock guitarist, played in bands until I was 19. I always enjoyed like messing around with, you know, tape recorders or four tracks or things like that. So then I went to college. I studied telecommunications and electronics, nothing to do with the field I ended up with in that classic, you know, something to fall back on mode. But by the time I was in first year in college, I went to college in Dublin. I'm from a town called Dundalk, which is between Dublin and Belfast. So when I went to college in Dublin, within a couple of months of starting college, I'd met some people I knew from home who'd somehow ended up buying an 8-track basic recording studio with a view to doing a soundtrack, and they didn't know how to work the stuff. So they said, will you come and help us do that? And so I did. And they were also running underground clubs in Dublin, like, you know, kind of independent artists. And through that, then we decided to start recording those. And then we quickly started releasing those records. And that kind of gave me a foothold in the kind of underground scene in Ireland. And that led to opportunities with other artists who were starting to tour a bit in the UK and stuff like that. And, you know, then it's just like one opportunity leading to another opportunity, and somehow ended up where I've ended up. That's the quick potted version of that.
So would you say that most of your expertise has been self-taught, learning on the job? It sounds like a common theme we've been hearing with sound people is that it's not even as the schooling as much as it is learning on the job as you go.
I mean, I've got nothing against the formalized education of what I do, but you're right. A lot of people who seem to end up, standing out a little bit, or you know, tend to have a, you know, not a similar background to me, but don't tend to come from a very kind of a classical schooling background. When I was kind of in my early 20s, you know, late teens, early 20s, I think there was one course in Ireland, you know, related to and at that time there was a sound recording course. The, you know, live sound was viewed as this, you know, a lesser child, as it were. So there was, you know, there wasn't even a specialized education you could do in it. Whereas, you know, now there's any number of courses, you know, even in the local college here in Dundalk, there's any number of courses you can do in it. So, you know, it's not necessarily out of design that I wasn't, you know, that I didn't do it at a third level, you know, in a third level classic education way. It just wasn't really an opportunity to do so. I still do think it's the best path to excel in it, though, is to learn on the job. Yeah.
One thing I saw a few years ago that has always stood out to me in terms of the science of sound was a video of Queen playing at Live Aid, and they're performing Radio Gaga, and that's where everybody's kind of clapping hands middle of the show. And that's used as an example of a traveling wave and a visual representation of it to see as the reaction of the crowd happens further and further back within the stadium. I don't think the audience thinks about how it takes time for sound to travel a distance, and a stadium is a distance where there is a perceptible delay or lag in the sound.
Yeah.
How do you work with that, and what do you have to do to account for that?
Well, you know, it's not about the speed of sound; it's about the difference in the speed of light and the speed of sound. You know, it's the differential of that is the issue. Luckily, in the world of, I mean, as you know, large scale concerts, you know, are more and more based around large scale video. And luckily, they're starting to use a lot of processing in that it creates a latency in the video. So that's helped us a lot in that, you know, it used to be an issue where somebody at the back of the stadium would, you know, on the big video screen would see the drummer hit the snare drum and then there would be a lag. And their assumption would always have been, there's something wrong with the sound, you know. Their first thought would never go toward the speed of sound and the speed of light being different. So yeah, like lately it's become a more manageable thing because there's latency in video now, which is getting us closer toward the median. I mean, you will never have a solution where it's a you know, a uniform experience for all. But luckily we're getting closer to a median where it's getting closer to acceptable. I think also an audience, you know, within a couple of minutes will kind of just adjust to it. And they may initially find it a little unsettling, but I think maybe that they, you know, it's something that you would self-adjust to.
Based on what you're saying, that a lot of people have the misconception that there's something wrong with the sound, when actually, as you said, it's the difference between speed of sound versus speed of light. What are other misconceptions that people tend to have about your work, about sound in stadiums, things like that?
Well, you know, one example that I've come up against recently is sometimes with the licensing that goes along with large scale events, local councils or local metropolitan areas or whatever will impose sound restrictions on the event. And these come in lots of different forms. They can be, you know, specifically because of a residence that's very close by, or they just have a general ordinance. You know, there's lots of reasons why we will have guidelines or limitations, depending on what way you want to look at it. And the audience, are oblivious to this generally. So I recently had quite a challenging show in the Napoli Stadium in Naples, where it was a very challenging number they wanted. They wanted 95 dB over the course of the show with an extremely loud singing along Italian audience. It was a difficult, you know, and obviously we'll talk more about dynamic later. I wanted to make sure that I won't name the artists who were in the previous show, but what happened to them is when you're dealing with an average over that amount of time, you can paint yourself into a corner really quickly and run out of runway at the end of your show, where this artist in particular had to finish their show around 90 dB. To comply with which in a stadium show that's
very
pretty
low.
Pretty quiet. And so I've had experience with this. So I made a judgment that, you know, I wanted to make sure that I didn't eat up all my energy too quick and make sure that I could finish the show strongly to leave the audience with, you're only as good as your last song kind of idea. And that they left the stadium feeling, that was, you know, it was quiet in sections, but it, you know, all good. Everybody's happy. And unfortunately, in the world we live in, all it takes is a couple of people to tweet something. You know, a number of my colleagues have had issues with this. You know, if you're doing a stadium show, it tends to be high profile in the locality that you're in, and the local press are just waiting for somebody to tweet, you know, oh, it's quiet, or oh, it's this, or oh, it's that, and they'll jump on it, and that's a story all of a sudden. Because, you know, all you got to do these days is string four tweets together, and you know, that's a news story. You know, mm-hmm. So that created a challenge. You know, that's the challenge. Well, not that. That's the misconception in the audience, is that they weren't aware that their own city council were imposing these restrictions on the concert, and their ire, for want of a better word, can be directed straight towards me, who simply has to comply with these regulations. So yeah, that's a current example I can give you of misconception.
Now, does that then lead to a conversation with you in the band of like, hey, I think this is what we need to do and how we need to do the sound to make this show as good as it can be given the restrictions we're playing under?
Well, you know, so this was with Cremonini, who's a big Italian artist. Mm-hmm. When you're dealing with a show like that, you know, we were in music rehearsals for 5 weeks. We were in stadium show rehearsals for weeks as well. So we have a show. We have a 2.5-hour show that's done. It's planned. It's, you know, it is what it is. So, you know, I can look at the set list and I can go, okay, I think I can steal a DB here. I can steal a D, you know, in different portions of the show. But it's not really, you know, I don't think it's really appropriate for the artist to have to, you know, change something that's, you know, that's very considered and very purposeful, you know, because of those restrictions. It was kind of more my job to make that work as best I could within the parameters that I was given.
So they're trusting you and your expertise to shine the best light on what they're doing.
Exactly. It's not what, from my point of view, I don't think it's, you know, it's necessarily helpful to, you know, before the artist is doing a show, start highlighting like all the, you know, we got big problems. You know, you don't want your artist going out feeling like that. You want your artist just knowing that I'm going to do the best I can for them.
So more of like, hey, I got you. You do your thing. I'll do my thing, and we'll make it work.
Yeah, we make it work as best we can. Yeah. I mean, there is an argument, oh, try and get the artist to rearrange the set list to try and somehow average out your DB level. You know, that's kind of, to me, it's like you put cart before the horse. It's regulation over art, you know, where it should be art, and then we figure out the regulation.
Are you ever nervous before a show because you're taking on the taking care of them, of making sure that you're going to make them sound good. You're taking on that burden, that challenge. So are you ever nervous going into a show, even if everything's been checked and ready to go?
I am always, always nervous before a show. Borderline terrified sometimes. And I think that's a healthy place to be, because, you know, if I'm not nervous, it's funny you talk about everything being checked on the Cremonini tour we just did. The art department had made this wonderful video pit. So we had a very large video screen, and they had this kind of, it's like an Alaskan landscape that slowly, as we got towards showtime, day became dusk, became night. And then the video then became the start of the show. It was a really nice piece, but it was like this impending sense of doom for me. I'd look up and I'd notice the sun had gone down, and like, okay, we're getting closer. And you're right, there is a moment where you do all your checks, and then you've done your last check, and then it's okay, we're ready for the show. And then the waiting after that is excruciating, because, you know, you've done everything you can, and then the show's going to start. I mean, this is more, especially when you're in large stadiums, where there's a lot riding on the show, you know, financially, and for all the people, 75,000 people who had to get babysitters, had to get transport. You know, it's a lot of effort for people to come to shows like that. And you're aware of that? Yeah, I'm always nervous. Always nervous.
Can you before talk
about- and then I mean, literally, you know, as soon as we get the first couple of bars done, then I'm fine. But yeah, definitely nervous before.
Yeah, the lead in. Can you speak about also some of the other dynamic challenges you encounter? Like, one thing I think of in a stadium type environment is, what if you have a dramatic temperature change, like a summer night where it's an outdoor stadium and it's really hot, and then it gets cool very quickly? Mm-hmm. Audiences don't often think about that's going to alter the physics and the acoustics and what's happening with the sound waves. How are you adapting dynamically when that's occurring?
So I will always work with very good system techs. So during the show, my role is simply to mix the music and to, you know, to mix the songs and operate the show. But I work with very good system techs. So, for instance, I'll reference the Cremonini tour again. We would be in the stadium the night before the show, and we would try to do most of our calibration work at an equivalent time to the start of our show. You know, whereas if we did it in the afternoon, it could be, you know, in Rome, it could be 40 degrees Celsius. And then by the time we do the show, it's much cooler, like you say. But we have a lot of tools available to us now. The two major brands that we would use are D&B, who are a German company, and L Acoustics, who are a French company. And both of those companies have really good tools to allow us to adapt as all the environmental stuff change. You know, for instance, the sub-propagation speed will change.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. November is Men's Health Awareness Month, so Talkspace wants guys to know that being prepared for life's biggest challenges and opportunities means prioritizing mental health, too. Talkspace can help you go beyond fine-tuned workouts, supplements, and productivity hacks. Talkspace can help you fine-tune your inner life so you can succeed in being the best version of yourself in any situation. And with Talkspace, you can get therapy from anywhere and on your time. You can even text your therapist between sessions. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace takes most insurance, and most insured members have a $0 copay. Men's Health Awareness Month is the perfect time to reach out to Talkspace. Now, get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com and save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com. That's Talkspace.com, promo code SPACE80.
When you add people in front of the subs, so like the phase alignment of low end can change as soon as you put human or blood bags, human bodies, you know, in between you and the subs. So, you know, factors that can come into play, not just temperature, humidity, cloud cover. When you're dealing with outdoor shows, I had an interesting experience the last time I did Glastonbury with Muse, where Glastonbury has some quite difficult, well, not strict noise criteria. And in this instance, we were dealing with 15-minute LEQs. So, you know, I was complying perfectly with the first, the second, and the third window. Everything was, you know, everybody's happy, everything's lined up. And then the cloud cover changed and the temperature changed slightly, and suddenly they wanted 4 dB off the show. And it's like, well, you know, I'm sorry, we're a little bit too far into it to do that. But it shows you the dramatic effect that those things can have on, you know, if you've got, especially the more remote the listening point is, those things can have really big effects. So, so the system tech is generally monitoring all this stuff. We have temperature probes, we have humidity probes. It's all being monitored. And I mean, if things significantly change, they'll generally talk to me first before we're altering the behavior of the system too much. We'll try to do that in a staggered manner so that we you don't want anything to happen that jolts the audience. You know, you gotta do it in a more subtle way. Mm-hmm. But yes, that's something that's monitored and we deal with that as it's happening.
Backup equipment do you have? Because there's taking precaution.
It's all about the horror today, isn't it?
Yeah. We want to hear about the challenges.
Yes.
How much backup do you have? Because there's taking precaution and then there's lugging around extra equipment everywhere you go, which 99% of the time I imagine is unnecessary.
Yeah, so you have to take you got to just kind of judge what pieces are, you know, for instance, I'll use some pieces that are now what you would consider vintage. And so you will generally have a backup of those things. Again, referencing Cremonini, I had a fully redundant system on that for my mixing world. I literally had a one button press and I had a completely redundant system that would instantly kick in and within a sample. That's an extreme example of that. I mean, what I tend to do is I'll tend to have levels of redundancy that I can instantly access. So for instance, if it's just one unit, that's simple. If it's like a whole rack has gone, I've got like a one button press to get me out of that. With the PA system itself, we'll have backup analog lines, we'll have backup digital lines, you know, we'll have redundant systems for that. What I like to do as well with the crew that I work with is to kind of take a leaf out of pilots' work, where, you know, when they have an emergency, there's no like gut feeling about what they think. They literally have a sheet and they follow the steps on that sheet. Mm-hmm. And so that the fog of the I mean, when you have something go wrong, I mean, it's not comparable to something going wrong in a flight, but, you know, when something goes wrong in the middle of a stadium show, it's quite a pressured environment, or becomes a very pressured environment very quickly. So sometimes it can be a fog that descends in those pressured situations. So what I like to is to try and you know, think of what are the situations that kind of arise. And then I kind of make a laminated sheet of if that happens, step. And included in that is also communication. Who's communicating when and how are they communicating? Because that can often be a problem when something goes wrong is, you know, people try to talk over each other, or, you know, sometimes it can't be, a mix up in communication. So that's something I think about as well, is like, who's going to talk when, who's saying what when, mm-hmm. you know, and how are we getting out of it? Luckily, none of those systems I've never had to use, but I like to think of them.
I would think in a situation like that, the more familiarity the team has with each other, the easier it is to navigate when things come up that are less predictable.
Yes.
Have you been around your team for many years, or do you find people come and go and new people get slotted in?
I have like a couple of core people that have worked with me. I mean, Eddie O'Brien, who's kind of like my right-hand man. He's done practically every show with me for the last 15 years. Matt Vickers from Scan, who's my main system designer. I've been working with him for over 20 years. So yeah, I mean, sometimes you find new people that you really want to pull into your team as well. So yeah, it's kind of a mix of that. As long as the more kind of senior people within that are more longstanding, they can, you know, our kind of methodologies are quickly passed along then as well, you know. Yeah, it's a mix. It's a mix. Yeah.
Technology has evolved so much over time in the past two decades or so. And we've spoken to people who want to grasp every new piece of technology and others that want to keep it more old school and stick to what they know, and that newer technology has not been in their favor. What's your take on that? Do you like to follow the technology as it evolves? Do you like to stay with what you know and what works?
I do both. So some of my methodologies are like right at the, you know, at absolutely what is the, I don't want to say cutting edge, but like quite, you know, up to like the moment. Like, I'm not afraid of the latest update or, you know, what the newest features are. I love that, especially with the Avid S6L platform as my mixing console. And I get right in there with the automation and event control on that. I'm kind of pushing their programmers along. I also helped develop the Fourier Transform, which is a new plugin host that Gareth Owen, who I know you had on, he pulled me in quite early on that. And so I had that out on Muse. We were one of the first artists to we were kind of alpha testing. It was literally like a bucket of bolts kind of thing. And I had one of Gareth's, Peter, who's like one of the partners in Fourier, literally sitting behind me writing firmware and handing firmware over to me. We're putting in the machine and we're trying it. And then on the other hand, I'm using like, you know, old Eventides and old pieces of gear as well. My ethos is generally just whatever the right tool for the job is, the right tool for the job, whether it's an old analog piece or it's the Fourier Transform, whatever the piece is that makes the most sense for the music, that's what I will use. I used to use the Midas XL4 analog console on Muse up to relatively quite recently, so 2018. So a lot of people had this idea that I was an analog purist and I was this, you know, diehard analog guy. And in fact, I was using like a small digital desk on the side, and there was less A to D and D to A in my current setup than there was on that setup, you know? So I wasn't really purist about any of it at all. And it was quite interesting when I moved to the Avid platform, a lot of people were going, oh, you know, I thought, you know, that the analog thing was much better. And in fact, it was just a tool, you know, it was just a tool.
We've heard from guitarists that we've talked to about this kind of preference for the old analog pedals and the specific sound that's going to create versus some of the newer digital technology, and how there's almost become a premium on that older gear that is not so easy to come across these days. Do you find that in the world of sound mixing, or is it kind of a healthy mix between like what you're talking about of utilizing digital but still incorporating some of the analog equipment?
I think it's interesting. I've just started to work with a band called My Bloody Valentine, are Kevin Shields on My Violent Side is you know, he's all about analog. You know, in his guitar world, whereas with Matt Bellamy in Muse, Matt he embraced the well, at the moment we use the fractal, but with Matt, for him it was all about getting the modeling correct. So they spent a long time making their own models within the fractal to really work. In the live domain, it works amazingly. You know, it really does. I think it will always be a mixture of those things. I prefer people who don't get too purist about something. You know, that is you know, where the ethos overrides the, you know, the end
functional,
not the end result, the functional. Exactly. Yeah. I tend to be more agnostic about all of it, and you know, if it sounds really good, it sounds really good. You know, that's my take on it. And I think that, you know, if you were to talk to me 20, even 15 years ago about digital versus analog, analog was still sounded much better. But where digital is now is completely different. You know, I think we're in a different world.
Tell us about the pros, the cons. That working with Muse, who you've been working with for such a long time, where you know their preferences, you know how their shows run, versus coming into a new band where I assume that it takes a lot of time to get to know their preferences, how they want things to go, but may also keep it fresh for you.
An extreme version of that recently with Cremonini, where I was going into a new artist, new band, in a new language, in a country, in a completely new environment, with a whole new set of you know, parameters. And it's always really interesting, because you also have to remember to bring some of yourself to it, because, you know, you have to remember that the reason they asked for you to join in this process. So you're one part of it is kind of this direction, but you have to remember to keep yourself within that as well, to give something back to them. Working with a new artist, it's always quite interesting, you know, that, like you say, you've got to learn a lot about them, about their approaches, their preferences. You know, sometimes you're learning about their history, obviously you learn their discography. And on the flip side of that, you're trying to see, well, what am I going to bring to them as well? Because, you know, they've come to look to work with me as well as me working with them. So That's kind of an interesting part when you're learning about them, is like trying to find the parts that you think that you can give back to them as well.
You know, you'd mentioned Gareth Owen earlier. We've spoken to a few Broadway sound designers and West End sound designers who also do productions throughout the world. And here you're talking about the idea of the artist is hiring you. So you're bringing something to the table and you need to stay true to yourself in the way you do your work. Then there's the artist and what they want from you. And then there's the audience and whatever the audience's expectations may be, different potentially sonic expectations from one culture to another, and you're working all over the world. Can you talk about if you factor in whatever those different cultural sonic expectations maybe, and how you've worked that into a mix, or if that's something you don't necessarily engage with?
Well, you know, without going into stereotypes, that's the tricky part, is you start to stereotype an audience. You know, the stereotype used to be that South American audiences, you had to mix much louder because they expected shows to be much louder. And in fact, you know, I've never really found that to be the case. With the artists that I'm working with, I think it's more important that we're presenting what it is the artist is trying to do than to try and double guess, you know, based on a supposition about your audience. There are certainly with South America, Italy, Spain, audiences will sing along, and they will sing along much louder than usual. So sometimes in certain songs, your loudness profile is a little bit higher to work with that. And then, you know, as you're moving from outdoors to indoors to stadiums to festivals, you know, there are different, I guess, focuses that you will have. Like, for instance, if we got to do a club show with Muse, that's going to be pretty intense. You know what I mean? So, but no, from like internationally, not so much anymore. And especially as, you know, speak, you know, So L-acoustics, D and B are all over the world now. So I'm generally dealing with the same sonic signature, you know, worldwide. Way in the past, you could be dealing with a lot of different, you know, varying degrees of quality of PA system, which
we've heard that as well.
Yeah. But in my experience, you know, certainly the last 10 years, that's not really so much the case anymore. There's a lot of kind of, you know, let's call them emerging markets, but, you know, like a lot of the Southeast Asian, like even into Indonesia, places like that, you're still getting that high quality of PA system. So you're not having to kind of do that adaptation, all of your signature is generally there, you know, and you're trying to give the audience, you know, the actual, the real deal, the real show, you know, not a facsimile of it, not one that's like been bent to fit something, but the, you know, the same show that somebody goes to see Muse in Madison Square Garden, that somebody goes to see them in Yokohama, or somebody goes to see them in wherever.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. November is Men's Health Awareness Month, so Talkspace wants guys to know that being prepared for life's biggest challenges and opportunities means prioritizing mental health, too. Talkspace can help you go beyond fine-tuned workouts, supplements, and productivity hacks. Talkspace can help you fine-tune your inner life so you can succeed in being the best version of yourself in any situation. And with Talkspace, you can get therapy from anywhere and on your time. You can even text your therapist between sessions. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace takes most insurance, and most insured members have a $0 copay. Men's Health Awareness Month is the perfect time to reach out to Talkspace. Now, get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com and save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com. That's Talkspace.com, promo code SPACE80.
Great. It's the same thing. It's the same signature. Yeah.
Can you recall a show that you've done, indoor, outdoor, stadium, that has particularly stood out to you? Something that you've either had an exceptional time, you felt really proud of your work, anything that's been standout in your career?
I guess one of the first big ones was when Muse headlined Glastonbury in, I think it's 2004, the first one. Where they were a surprise headliner. A lot of people were kind of going, what, Muse are headlining Glastonbury? To some people, they weren't seen as worthy or as, you know, but why should they be there? And they absolutely, you know, it was a phenomenal, they just played a phenomenal show. And it was almost like, you know, a light switch went off with a lot of people. And then that led to when Muse were the first band to play the new Wembley Stadium. And I'll never forget that first show. We did two nights. So how that show started was the band, there was kind of like a walkway that went down that met front of house. And to start the show, the band came underneath that walkway. And so my front of house area was blacked off and the band appeared behind me, which was, you know, very, very unusual. So, you know, the band are there. I've done all my checks and I'm kind of looking at my equipment. And, you know, in the movies, when lights go off, they kind of go, so I'm looking at my equipment and it's like it did that. And all my gear went off. And because all my gear went off, the music stopped. So the 80,000 people in the stadium thought the show was starting. So they've all started cheering and I had to kind of make go, okay. So that was a terrifying 5 minutes while we resolved that. So I'll never forget that one.
What happened?
There was basically I don't want to shop anyone. Let's just say somebody from a department plugged something into the lighting and plugged something into sound and joined the two together. And that was that. It was something like that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we got through it. And again, the show was amazing. And yeah, the two very memorable ones. And then recently, there's been a lot of them. Yeah. But they're two extremes.
Do you find those extreme moments add to the show, whether it's for positive or for negative? Do you feel like
You don't forget them. Yeah.
That's for sure.
You know, what you really want is a perfectly smooth show where everything's fine, and that's great. But yeah, you never forget the shows where challenges appear. I'll put it to you that way. Yeah, yeah.
Now, you had mentioned Madison Square Garden. That's one of the venues in the States that it's kind of a place that people aspire to play. And there's a few of those here, whether for an outdoor venue, a place like Red Rocks in Colorado. Are there any specific venues that you just enjoy working at or feels like something to be at over another place?
Well, I mean, yeah, Red Rocks is a good example of that. You know, there are a lot of beautiful venues. I'm a sucker for outdoors in Italy during the summer.
So either is it from the artist perspective, we'll hear from them kind of this awe type take it in moment when they're seeing that crowd at Madison Square Garden or they're walking out in Red Rocks and seeing the people cut amongst the rocks and what that looks like. That for you, are there places that kind of elicit that sort of oh wow moment?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So the Ziggo Dome in Amsterdam is just this sonic masterpiece. It's an amazing sounding venue. And it's just always a joy to work in that room. I mean, when I say room, it's like an 18,000 capacity arena, but it just sounds phenomenal. And it just like when you put the system on, you just smile, you know, and you know, your mix just, you just think you're the best mixer in the world when you mix it there, because it just sounds fantastic. And actually, the newly opened co-op in Manchester also sounds very, very good. But yeah, the Ziggo Dome in Holland is always a pleasure to mix in.
What is it about that physical space that lends itself to that good sound?
So they've done an excellent job in controlling sub, and everything is considered. So for instance, in a lot of arenas that we go into, they'll use glass, you know, around the arena for fencing
the boxes luxury.
There's the boxes, but even just like walkways will have a safety glass around them, and so you've got this like ring of perfectly reflective glass in a lot of arenas. Whereas you go to somewhere like the Ziggo Dome, they've got an acoustically transparent solution for that, you know, and where you know the building from the ground up has been built to sound good. Whereas, unfortunately, a lot of arenas we go into, they're really built as get the audience to the concessions as quick as possible kind of building, you know. So it's always a joy when you work in arenas like that. Stadiums is a different matter because, you know, the vastness is just different. But certainly, yeah, the Ziggo Dome in Amsterdam is always a joy.
I was going to ask you your workarounds for the venues that are not as superb in terms of their acoustics, physical space. What are your workarounds to try and maximize the sound quality?
That goes back to our system design. So what we're trying to do, we have tools to kind of to try and optimize this, is simply avoiding where we can reflective surfaces and avoiding putting energy where the energy doesn't need to go. So sometimes that can be just where we're shooting the PA, we can create little gaps to kind of minimize energy that are hitting certain things. You know, scoreboards is always that's always a joy. And then it's just optimizing the system that because you can't, you know, you don't want to change things so much that it changes the behavior of the system so that your mix becomes unsettled. So it's more about an optimization than a change. But yeah, that's certainly avoiding reflective surfaces, trying to focus the energy as best we can, is that they're the main tools we used to deal with that.
And diving into our area a little bit, how do you think about your ears and your hearing and keeping your ears safe working in these loud environments on a consistent basis?
So I'm in my front of house setup. I'm going to jump back a bit here. I very much like to think about the ergonomics is not quite the word, but like the space that I work in, I think about that quite a bit. And one of the things I like to do and how I set up my mixing system is that when I'm mixing the show, my hands are on the faders and I'm looking up and there's no screens. I'm not looking at screens. I'm not looking at data. I'm just looking at the artist and I'm reacting to the show as I hear it. But to my left and right, I have four screens, one of which is constantly showing me, the current 10 second, the current 15, you know, I'm constantly monitoring, the SBL because I like to mix dynamically.
Okay.
It's it's good information for me. Another byproduct of how I mix dynamically is that my kind of the LEQ over my whole show is not as much as you would expect. So generally it's, you know, even without restrictions, a Muse show, you know, is around 100, which will comply with most, German law, Swiss law, et cetera, et cetera. And that's without anyone restricting us. During the day, obviously, I'm in control of everything that I'm exposed to. I tend to just do what we need to do. I'm not going to sit around listening to music out of the PA for no reason at high level. We tend to do a lot of the time alignment work at low level. At quite low level, because we find that's a more precise way to do it. I'll only go to show level when I have to, and then generally the kind of long exposure is the 2 hours of the show where it's at show level, and that's about it. I would be way more concerned about being in a bar and someone shouting in my ear. Way more concerned about that. So I will, my hearing protection is on when I'm anywhere near those kind of environments. But I always. I'm SBL aware. I'm SBL aware when I'm, wearing my earbuds when I'm going for a run. Mm-hmm. I try to, it's like an athlete's going to take care of their fitness. I think it's, a good idea as a sound engineer to just be generally aware of what you're exposed to. Like when I go windsurfing, I make sure like my ears are protected. Mm-hmm. Anywhere I'm in an environment where I think it's going to be loud, I'm protecting them. So. I would not wear in ears. I've got to hear the acoustic space. I've got to hear, and what's very important to me as well is like how the audience are reacting. Like sometimes I like to, in moments with Snow Patrol especially, there's moments where I can pull the SBL quite low, and you have to really listen to the audience when you're trying to do something like that. When you're trying to pull things down quite quietly, you've got to really feel the room for that. So no, I would never. I would have headphones to solo things every now and again if I need to check something, but for
so
most
of could be dialed into the mix that at all.
No, so we have engineers on stage who are
the monitor engineers doing their thing. Monitors.
They're doing that, and they're all engineers, so I don't need to worry about any of that. I'm simply concerned with what the audience are experiencing.
And in that domain, is the venue deciding where your mixing table is going to be, or are you having a say relative to the stage setup and the PA where you're going to be placed?
In arenas and stadiums, that's something we have as a production talk back decided. It's interesting as the kind of current generation of PA systems, I can actually move back a little bit further. So I'm generally like 50 to 60 meters back from the downstage edge. In stadiums, you tend to that it's kind of like a show design decision where we will split the front of house. So instead of having like a big, back in the 80s and 90s, we had this big tower in the middle. That doesn't really happen anymore, where we split into two smaller low profile mix positions. So, I have my mix position, then lighting and video are over here. But once we've decided where that is, I'll have a conversation with the production manager. And once we've decided where that is or what that relationship is, that we can generally keep that fixed as we move around stadiums. And the same is true when we move around arenas. So you can get accustomed to what's happening at that position, and you learn to judge from that position. So to try and keep that as a static relationship.
So one less variable.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
You have a preference, an ideal space, physical space that you want to be located?
Yes. So, in arenas, it's like 50 meters with D&B. And then in stadiums, it kind of varies. There is no real ideal for that, but I'm trying to think actually what the distance is at the moment. It's like 75 meters when we're offset. Yeah.
Can you talk about some of the challenges of mixing for a stadium that's open versus a stadium with a dome and what you have to consider in that?
Well, stadiums with domes suck. No, that's not completely true. I luckily haven't had to do a lot of stadiums with closed roofs. So I can't really answer too much that when I've had to do it. I mean, again, with modern line array systems, it's for my outlook is just about controlling energy. I like to use ring systems and, you know, quite considered delay systems. We get quite precise about where our delay speakers are, where our ring system is. We're trying to maintain image all the time. We're trying to avoid what we call the train station effect, or where we're trying to make sure that the listener perceives the music as coming from where the music's coming from, i.e. the stage, so that things are, you know, disconnected. But we will try to make sure that we're only putting the energy into the space that we need to, that we're not, you know, we're not trying to overshoot anything, you know, where the longer the distance you're trying to, modern align arrays can throw quite a distance. But if you're in an acoustic space that's, shall we say, not ideal, and the more air that you're, you know, air is still the medium, you know what I mean? And it's an imprecise medium. And the more you're doing that, the more turbulence or randomness, if you want to call it that, you're creating within that space. So our outlook is all to, all, you know, we use more of less speakers, if you know what I mean. So the delay speakers up high, you know, very considered delay positions, so that we're minimizing the amount of energy that's been pushed into the space. And that's how we try to kind of minimize the randomness of the poor acoustic spaces sometimes. That makes sense?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So my last question for you is there any either band or venue that you aspire to either work with or play at one day?
So venue, I have done it as a support act, but I've never kind of done the big show there, is Croke Park in Dublin, which is, I think it's like 90,000 capacity. It's a huge stadium in Dublin. So, oh, sorry, and Slane Castle in Ireland is another one. So they're both hometown shows. They're two that I would, yeah, for sure love to do. Artist, I already work with them all, so it's all good.
So
good answer.
My last question for you would be, when people ask, why are concerts so loud, what would your answer to that be?
Why are concerts so loud? It's a funny thing, because if a concert has to be quiet, you will hear a lot of complaining, you know.
The irony.
Why are concerts so loud? I think sometimes people, you know, who are not used to what a large concert is, I think that, you know, the kind of the broadband physicality of, you know, sub and a large space like that can maybe confuse them about what the actual SBL they're experiencing is. Hmm. You know, sometimes that can be affected. Unfortunately, that, you know, that there are some people who mix shows really, really loud, like to you know, in my opinion, way too loud. Mm-hmm. I think that is an issue, but I think they're free to do that. It's their artistic choice. Why are concerts too loud?
Well, so not necessarily loud, too loud. So loud.
Yeah, so loud. I think part of it is the physicality of what it is can belie the actual SBL that they're experiencing. If they're not used to, or, you know, if they've gone to their first show, I mean, it could be a Taylor Swift show or a Coldplay show or whatever. And, you know, they may perceive that as just being really loud. And the other thing is, if you've got like 20 people around you all singing at the top of your voice, at the top of their voice, it is probably louder than the PA system, or as loud as the PA system, you know, in that localized space that you are in. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going to be really loud.
And for you, that sweet spot with the PA is about 100 dB?
Well, it depends. You know, that completely depends. I find that it tends to average out over the LEQ of a show with Muse, for instance, you know, 100, something around that. And there's big peaks and troughs in that. Like I say, I mix quite dynamically. It's you know, it's an interesting thing for me is that it's the one thing that this medium has is, you actually have a huge dynamic range that you can play with, you know, and like I, for instance, I don't use any compression on my mix really at all, because I love the freedom of the, you know, you've got the full spectrum of dynamic range available to you. And I also find it quite interesting that people don't kind of, I mean, it's the simplest trick that I have is the master fader, moving that up and down. the emotional kind of response you can elicit out of doing that is huge, you know, and it's a simple thing. And yeah, I end up with that average, but there's big kind of journey to get to that. Yeah.
Fascinating. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on today. We've really appreciated getting to hear more about you, your work, and we look forward to seeing all the work you're going to continue doing in the future. Why don't you tell our listeners where they can find you, connect with your work, learn more about you and what you're up to?
I'm on Instagram, Mark Carlin. Our recording studio is called Black Mountain Studios here in Ireland, if anybody's interested in recording. And then I also have my new Black Shore studio that I'm here in mix room. So if anybody needs any mix work, they can reach out to me here. And I'll be on Turret News in 2026, I guess. So come say hi. And My Bloody Valentine later on in 2025.
Awesome. And we'll link to those in the episode description. And again, thank you so much for taking the time to be on Hear Us Out.
You're very welcome. You're very welcome. Thanks, guys.
I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
3 employees and 2 work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humour. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
Check engine, ABS, or maintenance light on? Take the guesswork out of your warning lights with O'Reilly Veriscan. The service is free and provides a report with solutions verified by ASE-certified master technicians. And if you need help, we could recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.